Cheerlady and Friends, Cosmic going for refuge, and the introduction to the refuge tree. I noticed there were a few chuckles there. I'm paraphrasing or kind of paying a humble homage to Bhante Sangharakshita, who would start his talks with those kind of phrases through the decades. Well, we are celebrating his 89th birthday this week. So I would like to dedicate the talk to him. I mean, I wouldn't be standing here. I wouldn't be probably have much knowledge of the Dharma. The centre probably wouldn't be here. Older members, no older members, no mitras, no retreats. So I feel I owe a lot of gratitude to Bhante Sangharakshita. We're at a new and unusual point in history that we can look back on all the periods of Buddhism, of the Dharma. I mean, when they were practicing back thousands of years ago, even, or maybe even 100 years ago, there wasn't such a perspective. And I think Sangharakshita offers us a fantastic wealth of a treasure house of teaching on that perspective, especially for Westerners that are want to put it into practice. And he's still with us. I just feel grateful that my life's overlapped with his life. And he isn't, I don't think he's receiving visitors, but you can write to him. And so by all means, read other teachers, but don't overlook or don't underestimate Bhante. I think I'm saying that to myself. I mean, I was a mitra for 10 years. So, I mean, I did a lot of mitra study, read a lot of Bhante, listened to a lot of his lectures. But even preparing for this talk, I went back and I still learned more. There was still more to learn. So with his teaching of the Dharma and the system of practice, I feel I've got more than enough to be getting on with. My first contact with the Dharma was here at the Glasgow Buddhist Centre in the mid-80s, and I used to get these... I came for a meditation course. I was quite tentative about Buddhism. I wasn't sure about religion and Buddhism. And I eventually got ordained. But I would tentatively look at the cassette library. We used to have cassettes in those days. And I used to look up in the wee booklet and go, well, that looks interesting. I would get one of them out. I always remember, I think it was about my third choice of tape, I got one in Zen. I'd heard of Zen, I didn't know what it meant. I can't remember the exact title. I think it was The Essence of Zen or something like that. I thought, oh, goody, I was quite excited about this goody, Zen, this thing, goody. I was like a little kid who got his new single by his favourite band. And I went all the way home and dug it out and opened the box, and there was nothing there. There was no tape inside the box, so just nothing there. Empty. So it was empty. So we're talking about shunyata and emptiness a bit later. But I think that was, looking back, maybe that was a direct teaching from Bhante to me. So. Definitely a direct transmission outside the scriptures. Another early talk that I listened to by Bhante was, is religion really necessary? I can actually still remember two things from that talk. One is that religion is what man or mankind does with his aloneness. And also the purpose of life is to grow. And that kind of was hooked me in. Maybe that was a very tiny seed that's kept growing. And as I will explain later, these are points bring us to our subject this evening, the cosmic level of going for refuge. And as Virochana said in his introduction, this is the last of the series of talks. We went from the cultural to provisional, and the effective and the real going for refuge. I think from the cultural level that we can see that we can't be born a Buddhist, but even though we might be born into a Buddhist culture, a Buddhist family, going for refuge to the Dharma and Sangha has to be done voluntarily and quite consciously. We have to make effort. We have to open ourselves, commit ourselves to practicing the teachings of the Buddha, open ourselves up to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So going for refuge isn't something we just do once. The very title is, it's like a ongoing. We commit ourselves to becoming a Dharma practitioner, when we become a mitra and order member, but it's something we keep bringing back to, coming back to. As Jyoti Pachni said in her first talk, what we're thinking about a lot, or what we're obsessing about a lot, is probably what we're going for refuge to. Okay, we have to make a shopping list, we have to go to the bank or that kind of thing, but what mostly our mind turns to is probably what we're going for refuge to. So it's a bit like the mindfulness practice, really. We get distracted, we start thinking about other things, we go off the breath, we go away from the body, we make a shopping list, whatever. It's when things preoccupy us, maybe more like work or romance or sexual relationships and family, which is fine, you know, but it's just to gently, kindly bring ourselves back to the three jewels, to our Buddhist practice. So someone who's committed to the Dharma enough to be or become ordained and do the training towards ordination, it's witnessed as being effective, and the next step is what Vrochna was talking about last week, is the practice becoming real. And that's what real going for refuge is, what's traditionally known as stream entry. They've entered somewhat upward stream, so to speak, and their practice cannot fall back. It's not strongly bound by the conditions of greed, hatred and delusion, but informed by generosity, compassion and wisdom. And so generosity, altruism can be practiced in lots of different ways, but one of the best, the most highest ways, is the gift of the Dharma. And although becoming an order member doesn't mean you become a teacher, it's a way of giving, is to speak at a centre, or teach in a centre or a retreat place. There was one we missed out, actually, that was a ultimate going for refuge. And in the talk that this comes from, it's called The Levels of Going for Refuge by Sangharakshita from 1978. He says about ultimate refuge, it's kind of indescribable unless you're actually enlightened. It's synonymous with enlightenment. So one's own so Sangharakshita says about this stage is that one is one's own refuge. In fact, at this level, there is no inside and no outside, because there is no self and no other. So one cannot say really more than this. But after this, as if almost to emphasise that going for refuge has no end, it's actually infinite, he adds another level. The cosmic. So, but he says this, although this goes on to sound quite grand, it isn't actually a level, but more of a context, which involves our internal worlds and our outer worlds, as far as our imagination will take it, but also transcending both inner and outer, subject and object. So, as we come in contact with the Dharma, the cosmic going for refuge is something that imbues it. It involves not only ourselves but all other beings. This relates to the earlier statement that the purpose of life is to grow. In effect, plants, animals and humans have the opportunity to develop, and so that's, to that extent, they're going for refuge in the widest sense. However, as we know, there's different levels of consciousness, from the amoeba to the blade of grass and then to the human state. The human state's regarded as a very precious state. It's a rare opportunity to develop. partly because of consciousness in the human state, is that we're aware that we're aware. And we can use that awareness to more deliberately make choices and actions, to become more insightful, become more compassionate. Yeah, it begs the question, doesn't it? Are humans really the top of the food chain, as it were? They seem to cause so much damage to other life forms, the planet, engage in centuries of war, murder, abuse, torture of their own kind, you know the story. It's almost as if the responsibility and power for the position of being human is almost too much of a burden to bear, and we blow it. So rather than look at our own darker sides, we project them onto others individually and collectively. It's not us, it's them. It's not I, it's it. So we kind of dehumanise and even demonising others in the process. This is what the psychologist, psychoanalyst Carl Jung called the shadow. So if we kind of go towards light, we're going to project the shadow. So if we want to fully engage with the spiritual life, we'll inevitably come up against our own shadows. It's significant in the historical Buddha, he was actually a warrior caste before he became a warrior of peace, because I think the spiritual life can at times be a bit of a battle, an internal battle of conflicts between our many tendencies and even different selves. These conflicts can be described as occurring between the heart and the mind, or the unconscious and the conscious. You may notice that when we're under the throe of negative emotions in unskillful states, we've lost our perspective. The bigger picture's gone. Our sense of self becomes disconnected, smaller, narrower, harder, tighter, more fixed. And let's face it, probably uglier. We are only concerned with me, me, me. I've noticed the negative states can arise at really unusual times, even on retreats. When I spent a long time practicing the Dharma, near the end of retreats, in my ordination retreat, I was there for 4 months, and I think about 3.5 months you get ordained, and the last retreat, the last part of the retreat, so it's like an order retreat. And at that point, in my head, Mr. Hyde came out. He just wanted to rubbish everything. He just wanted to rubbish everything I'd achieved. He wanted me to smash the shrine and see everything was garbage, and I just had to, talking to my public preceptor Surita, I just had to give him room and just let him tire himself out. It was almost like a hopping dark character with a top hat, but it was just this how I envisioned him. And then another time was I was on a short solitary retreat recently up in Assen in the northwest of Scotland. And it was a friend's house, I'd kind of got back into my meditation, etc. Nice walks. There were people around. It wasn't that solitary. But then, on the last day, I was leaving the next day. People came. There was cars in the drive, and then they were setting up tents across the road, right where my view was. And I just get this kind of angry of Tunbridge Wells, Basil Fawlty. What are they doing here? And then a farmer came along and kind of waved him, oh, this is like, he's going to tell them off, he's going to chase them away. And then he started helping him set up another tent. I thought, hold on a minute. You know, I was having all these fantasies of, well, the wind will blow it away, or this. I'll go out in the night with a knife and cut the ropes. And then I thought, hold on a minute, Celia, you're getting carried away here. It isn't even your house. Why am I being so annoyed? And I just thought, I was just reacting, and I was projecting a story onto these people, and then I was having a reaction to the story that I projected. It was nothing to do with them being there. And then in the end, they were just sleeping there. I think they went up to the house and came back. I was expecting campfires and parties and And I was going home the next morning anyway. So it's just how you can just project something out and then make a big story of self-righteousness about it. So working with these negative emotions is a challenge to our mindfulness. If we can notice them or even catch them in the bud, we're less likely to be overwhelmed by them or taken over by them. You may remember the antidotes in meditation classes: consider the consequences, develop the opposite, and one of course was going for refuge, bring the refuges to mind, the Dharma, Buddha Dharma Sangha, or an image or a phrase or a mantra. And the way such reactionary destructive views and emotions are out of sync with reality, and the complete opposite of the cosmic, which is a vision, it's a vision of Mahayana Buddhism especially. So it's expansive, it's beautiful, it's imbued with metta and compassion, wisdom and peace. It's connected with all life. It's infinitely creative. It transcends beyond our imaginations, our own linear sense of time and space. It has without beginning or end. So it paints a very grand picture. But it can also be very related to the very fabric of life, which is always changing and developing. I think last week Virochana spoke about the laws of conditionality, which is sometimes called conditioned co-production. It's the basic premises that in relation to conditions things arise, and then without these conditions things cease. But ultimately things can just be seen as a process of change, a process of conditions coming and going, that there's no fixed objects or beings, but just a stream of moving conditions of cause and effect. And these are the niyamas that are considered orders of that conditionality. So I'll just describe them briefly. There's the physical, there's the organic, there's the subjective order, or the of imagination, the psychology. And there's the karmic, which is action, skillful and unskillful. But there's also this transcendental order, sort of the spiritual path that leads from dukkha to awakening, a gradual progressive path. Sometimes called the Dharma Niyama, I think they call it Dharma. So Svanti's higher evolution, I feel particularly, borrows from the organic level of conditionality, but it's really referring to the Dharma Niyama. Like the other orders of conditionality, the influence of the Dharma Niyama is always there, so to speak. But however, coming aware of it, coming into contact with this influence, again, as I said before, it takes effort. We need to set up the conditions to do so. But ultimately, it's what we're doing when we undertake any form of Buddhist practice, meditation, study, puja, go to a class or retreat. We're making effort. We're opening ourselves up to something other, something mysterious, a way of being which we can only take in stages and small glimpses, a gathering of small insights. In the Trinatma movement, there's a system of practice. Which corresponds also to meditation, but it's a practice of the cushion as much as on the cushion. So we have mindfulness, metta, and just sitting. So mindfulness corresponds to integrating these different parts of ourselves. Metta is positive emotion, friendliness, kindness, and just sitting is receptivity, which we sometimes do between each. So these are sometimes known as samatha, or calming practices. And it's really helping us to become a happy, healthy human being. Someone fairly integrated, someone fairly positive. The Dharma is giving direction and meaning to one's life. But there's still that sense of self. And I think that's important, to have a sense of self. to be somebody going somewhere. Because when we move into what we call the insight practices or vipassana practices, that can challenge your sense of self, even your sense of reality, what's real, what's unreal. So we need a strong sense of self to begin with. Or else we can just get quite thrown by the challenges of furthering our practice. So the two practices that we take up in the movement when we ask for ordination are the six element practice and the visualization of the refuge tree prostration practice. The six element practice, just briefly, is it's considering the elements, inner and outer, and then letting them go and giving them back to the outer world. So we've got earth, fire, water, air, space, and then consciousness. So the meditation goes through each of these six stages. You can see it in detail in Kamala Shiva's book on meditation. There's also a lovely poem by Bhante called The Six Elements Speak. But basically it's loosening up that sense of self and sense of owning, so to a very basic level of the elements, including consciousness as our mind. So kind of grandly that's called spiritual death. But what's going to arise? You know, is this going to be a black hole, a blue sky? But still we're ourselves. I mean, when I do the practice, I get up. You know, I've still got my body. I still walk around. But it's obviously challenging something deeper, that my views, my ideas of fixedness, not just in me, but how I see other people. So it kind of prepares us for the next practice, which is associated with the visualization of the refuge tree prostration practice, which is moving towards ideas of what can emerge. But it's not like we just leave the other practices behind. It's not like when someone becomes ordained, they just do six element visualization. We still go back and work on our integration, our friendliness, kindness, receptivity. So we keep going back into it. It's like continually building and building on top of it. But the spiritual rebirth kind of requires an imaginal faculty to connect with the ultimate goal of development. I suppose it works on our faith, really. Faith strata is placing the heart upon. In a very simple, basic way, what we need faith in is really just in ourselves, that we can change at a very simple level. But what would this ultimate goal look like? Enlightenment? Nirvana? And how would we then experience the world if we were enlightened? What would it be like to meet someone who's enlightened? Would we recognise them? How would we notice? Could we tell? What was the Buddha really like? So we can consider all the images that emerge through history to the present day as attempts to visually represent through colour, shape and form what that experience of awakening and the fallen way of being could be like. There's so many Buddha images around us now in pubs and restaurants. But it is possible to seek one out that moves you and you feel connected with. The fat Chinese Buddha isn't really a Buddha. He's actually based on a wandering Chan monk called Chi Tzu, who then became known as Putai. Putai means hempen sack. I don't think it refers to his belly, it's a sack on the back. Carries around, and apparently had sweets or treasures. And so he's almost like a fatherly figure. Maybe a bit like Chinese Father Christmas. So he's sometimes seen as a protector of children as well as the poor. But children, when they come here,
they're always good at asking awkward questions, children, so they'll say, why has the Buddha got big ears? What's that point on his head? So, I mean, I've been coming here for years and I never really thought about it, so I had to do a bit of research. So even in the Pali Canon, there's poetic descriptions of the Buddha, and these marks of the Buddha are kind of equated quite a lot with the marks of a remarkable person. They list 32 and then they list 80. So I've got a few for you here. So the big ears, well, all the better to hear you with. Because he's all hearing. And apparently the long lobes are to do with his princely life before he had jewels. So maybe to do with his materialism of his princely life before. The top of the head, the point, is called it Ushnisha, if you can pronounce it right in Sanskrit. Ushnisha. It's made of radiant flesh, round and circling clockwise. When seen from a distance, it seems to be four finger widths high, but upon closer scrutiny, its height can never be measured. A bit like enlightenment itself. This is the most difficult physical feature to achieve, and the result of having always visualized the spiritual mentor on the crown of the head. I guess that's more to do with a remarkable person. As well as having visited temples and monasteries, engaged in spiritual practices. So it's a sign of development, kind of positive development. But my favourite one I've kept for last. His skin is luminous and golden in colour from having offered soft and comfortable seats to others. It's not just any old seat, it has to be soft and comfortable. But I suppose it just means radiant and positive. I guess the sort of white Western equivalent would be rosy cheeks, because people in India do look golden in the summer. I better say where I got these from. It's from someone called Dr. Alexander Bezrin, Dharamsala Archive of Tibetan Archives, 1982. That's the website. So I've got a quote here from Sangharaksha again. This is Sangharaksha talking about the god Apollo, the Greek god Apollo. We can now understand that the Buddha is not to be recognized by his marks. It is all a question of looking deeper. The Victorian art critic Ruskin made the point that if we imagine that we know who Apollo is through looking at a statue of him, we are mistaken. Apollo is not that particular shape at all. Indeed, the shape of Apollo can never be captured in sensuous terms. Apollo is a significance, a spiritual force that can never be represented. The more we rely on external appearances, the more likely we are to be misled. Although, and it is very important to make this into account, close attention to appearances will take our perception deeper. So the whole history of Buddhist images, there was the empty throne, there was the empty horse, there was the tree, the Buddha tree. There's lots of images of trees through the Buddha story. He died between two sala trees. His mother gave birth holding onto a tree. We had the footprints, and then eventually the figure. It became embodied in a figure. And sometimes just descriptions. He was so kind, and so Ananda was made disciple of Ananda.
So we're kind of moving into the realm of myth and symbol and colour, and we can bring that alive with the use of arts and music and drama, painting, but also through ritual, etc. But I feel I have to explain myth and symbol, but at no other time in history have we had to explain myth or symbol. It's just been part of our life, our day-to-day life. It started to be chipped away in the 19th century. We've become so rational and analytic, technological and scientific, we try and explain everything away. And although I'm emphasising maybe the unconscious side, the emotional side, it's not that I'm trying to get rid of the rational. We still keep the rational side, the thinking side, but we need to emphasise more the emotions, because I think because of our cultural conditioning. We don't want to be dead from the neck down. Another phrase is to find emotional equivalence to intellectual understandings. Again, it's the spark of faith. But I was dumbfounded for years about how faith arises from dukkha. Dukkha, dissatisfaction, is the first step on the path, and in dependence on that arises faith. And I thought, no, let's just go to the pub. Let's go under the duvet. If you're dissatisfied and everything's horrible, get away from it. And to bring that round to faith and then the Dharma seemed like a real effort. But I found something recently. Subhuti was talking about the mythic context, and he was talking about boredom and how it's important to acknowledge your boredom. And rather than just turn on the computer or turn on the telly, distract ourselves, just to notice the boredom, rather than just entertaining ourselves. If we're bored, we're numb, just let it in, feel it. Subhuti feels it's a sign of lack of emotional engagement, but also the need for meaning. We could go out and do the sex, drugs and rock and roll, but it would only result in a loop. You'd come back round again to the boredom, the numbness, chasing your own tails, the hangover for the dukkha. So rather than distracting ourselves and trying to escape, the boredom can be a reminder that we've lost our vision and the first step in the Noble Eightfold Path. And we need to reconnect, we need to a further sense of aliveness. Inspiration. Again, the arts depict, I think, this need for myth. I mean, there was the popularity of The Hobbit, the Star Wars, Harry Potter, these kind of things, although there might be slight tinge with fantasy, they're a need for the mythical in popular culture. So it's a need for a sense of the imaginal, a sense of myth. In their own lives, the contact, the Dharma Niyama. And the mythic dimension, like the Dharma Niyama, is there all the time at the back of our lives. We'll be just not conscious of it. We're not in touch with it. So there's a way of contacting it through practices of puja, recollecting, reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, and of course, images. And it's what's behind the images, what Jung called the archetypal, the deep meaning. And as Bhante in the quote of Apollo, we can go into the deeper meaning actually by paying more attention to the image, by entering into a relationship with the image. Another famous quote by Sangharakshita is, before there could be a development of Buddhism in the West, we would have to have a revival of paganism. And when I was lucky enough to meet Bhante on my own, I asked him about this. I said, well, what did you really mean by a revival of paganism? Is it universal? Is it in the country, in the culture, or is it individual? And he felt it was more actually about the individual.
that we get in touch with nature, the seasons, the elements, nature as a teacher. If you've ever been on retreat and you become quite mindful, it's like everything is full of meaning. It's like, I remember being on a solitary after a puja, coming out and seeing a full moon, and then it looked like a strange bird on the horizon, but it was actually a rabbit. It was like the rabbit's ears. I thought it was a beak. And then I saw a shooting star, and it all seemed very meaningful. And I think, you know, if we look, nature's teaching us all the time. So we have to kind of approach with an open mind, a sense of wonder, that aspect of mystery in the Dharma. And it means bringing in other faculties that kind of unite so heart and mind. The faculty of imagination that brings us more into contact with reality, unlike fantasy, which takes us away. One of my fantasies is it's clean. One of my fantasies is coming off retreat, and I'm waiting on the bus and on the country road, and I expect the guys from ZZ's Top to turn up in the car with those keys, and they're going to take me off into this hedonistic lifestyle, but it never happens. So imagination brings us back into nature. And the famous one now, we all want, you know, the lottery, that's everyone's fantasy. And the faculty of faith, I think they're linked to the imagination and faith, is what ignites us, brings us more into contact with reality. Sangha likes to describe faith as that which is ultimate in us, responding to which is ultimate in the universe. So we can surround ourselves by good images. As I said before, there's so many. But we have to work to engage with them. I've got a friend at work, she likes Buddhas and collects them and likes a kind of peaceful image, and that's fine, you know, I can appreciate that. And I actually gave her a Buddha, a Buddhist image, a female Buddha. But if we want to practice, we want to go deeper. We have to go beyond society's conditioning about looks and the surface of appearances. Watching, observing, but not really seeing can keep us on the surface, keep us outside. Like watching a ritual, watching someone chant, it's quite different from actually doing it ourselves, isn't it? Getting inside the experience. And it's the same with symbolic images. They can act as a door. However, we have to make an effort to engage, open ourselves up to them, like a practice, really look at them and deeply relate with them to encounter the archetypal dimension. It's a sense of meaning behind it, but it's what sometimes described as undefined meaning, beyond words, and the fact that the symbols are entrances to the inconceivable. But if we remember that part where Bhante was asking us to really look, really look. But when was the last time we really looked at someone or an object without staring? Opened ourselves out to someone or something through the senses, primarily visual, and really seeing what's in front of us. Actually experience the other internally as well as externally. It can be a profound experience. If we can really see this in the full sense, it's only then we can begin to understand another being. We used to do these things called communication exercises, which most people dreaded, which involved having a partner. You look at each other, it's something you don't know before, and then you'd have a phrase, like very basic factual phrase, like the sky is blue today, water is wet, the cow is in the field. Another person would have a phrase, they'd say their phrase, and then you would pick one of the phrases, another person would say yes, and then they would pick a phrase, and then you would say yes, and then you just go back to just looking. Sounds terrifying, does it? Doesn't it? But I remember a couple of times having quite a strong experience and they're just looking at the end. It was just like, it was like the, it was like something opened up, it was something bigger. I sometimes have the experience in practice of having to go down a narrow corridor. It seems I'm dreading this, but I have to do it, practice and this sense of discipline, and then it opens out into something bigger. And it happened when I was doing the communication exercise with these people. It was almost like two mirrors looking, reflecting each other. We were seeing each other in each other. Another one was Surita, my public preceptor, was getting to do garden practice. I wasn't doing any digging or anything. I was actually just looking at the garden, and I was under an awning and I was looking out into the garden of Paparoka. And again, it was just something, just when I was meditating and practicing, it wasn't just I was sitting there staring at the garden for weeks, but again there was a feeling of connectedness with the nature that was outside and that was inside. It was kind of breaking down the barriers somewhere. The cosmic also corresponds to the Mahayana and the idea of universality, but also the altruistic aspect. That's an intrinsic part of our practice. It's not only for ourselves, but for all beings. And Sangharakshita's got a very good way of approaching the Mahayana, and he talks about texts, but I think it can also be applied to approaching the images of Buddhism as well. For your part, just read it like a story, and whatever you do, don't think, don't try to work it all out, don't ask yourself what it all means, just let your mind stop ticking and take it all in. If you want to set your intellect to work in it, you can do that later on. For the moment, just absorb the content of the sutra as though you were watching a film in the darkness. This is something transcendentally surrealistic, and you really haven't a hope of working it all out. So just let your rational mind go to sleep for a while, and allow the pictures to have their effect, and don't be afraid of allowing yourself to feel. So on the shrine we've got three images of the refuge tree. They're actually photographs of paintings by Aloka of the refuge tree. I'm kind of maybe stating the obvious there. And then we also have an image of Sangharakshita and his teachers, which is part of the bottom part of the refuge tree. And then on the left we have an image of a Dakini. The Dakini kind of corresponds in Vajrayana as one of the esoteric refuges. They're not esoteric because they're kept away or a secret, but because they correspond to emotions, experiences that are difficult to actually talk about, to speak about. And she's quite a kind of raffle figure, energetic figure. She's a sky dancer, she's very free, she can go in any direction. So she's a symbol of well, lots of things. There's lots of symbols don't have any end. The meaning goes on and on, unlike a sign which has got one meaning. But she's the esoteric symbol of the Sangha. So it's kind of like inspiration, really. We are communicating well with someone, we're sparking each other off, inspiring each other. Or we listen to someone speak, it's inspiring. Or listen to a talk, it's inspiring. In a way, that's the Dakini being evoked. Um, and also the Buddha. The Buddha, you know, lived 2,500 years ago. But as I said before, we have teachers. We have the esoteric image, symbol of the Buddha is the guru. So anybody who's teaching us or that we learn from could be someone in the centre, could be a friend. And I work in kind of care work and health work, and I see some people that I'm helping as my guru. I'm working with a girl just now who's visually impaired, and she's just teaching me patience. So it's very flexible, you know. You could become the guru, you could be helping and teaching. And then the third one is the Dharma refuge, and the Vajrayana, it's the Yidam, which is again a symbolic image of enlightenment. In a way, it's said to be us at the end of the path. Sublime and glorious though it may be, it is in fact you, is the new you, you as you will be, if only you allow yourself to die. So we're coming to the refuge tree now in the prostration practice. So Aloka describes these images as a key or a map. It's not the terrain itself, it's a kind of finger point to the moon, something again to be worked with. But also challenges our Western view of photographic reality. It's not painted in Renaissance perspective or perspective that we see in photographs. No way would have got all these people together for a nice group photograph. And Hockney describes that way of looking as the view of a one-eyed frozen man looking through a window, because we don't see, we're moving all the time, we've got two eyes, we don't kind of see this window all the time. We're in the world. So how we see reality visually is part of conditioning and is much challengeable as well. And an icon deliberately doesn't use the perspective. It doesn't have the vanishing point that things disappear into. In a way, you're the vanishing point that's coming towards you. And things are bigger, but not because they're near, but because they're more important. And Aloka describes also the brocade that goes round. You see brocades round Buddhist paintings, and these are called spectrum doorways. They've got basic colours of red, blue, yellow, and that's called the spectrum doorway. So it's welcoming us in to the space. It isn't keeping us out, it's actually trying to bring us in. So the refuge tree represents dimensions of history and timelessness on one plane. It's a symbol of all the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, but most of all it probably represents the red blazing jewel of the Sangha, especially the Arya Sangha, the Noble Sangha. It's almost as if we've been standing, getting on with our life, talking to each other, going to work, hanging out with our Sangha friends around the centre, our family, workmates. And then we turn round, and there it is behind us, going back in history, all throughout time and space. All those who went before us on the path, we can be seen as teachers of the Dharma, teachers of enlightenment. So there's about 44 figures on there, so we'd be here till this time tomorrow if I went into detail. So I'm only going to give a kind of general broad brush description of the practice and the image. I'd recommend Kulananda's book. It's a wonderful book for anyone to read. It's called Teachers of Enlightenment. It's on the left hand side of the shrine. I find it very useful. And there's also some book about his teachings. And there's this thing about bowing. We do this bowing thing, which is unusual for us in the West. In the East, it's just a matter of greeting. You know, they may just put their hands together, maybe a little bow or whatever. It's just a normal hand mark of respect. But in the West, it's a big thing. It's like, well, what's this? What am I bowing to? What's this thing? And I was the same. It took me a while. And again, it was this. Again, I suppose it corresponds to the definition of faith. It was the potential of me being realised externally, and I was acknowledging it. That was how I got over my arrogant Western view of my bowing. So it's also, I suppose, it's a mark of respect, internal and external. So I took up the prostration practice when I asked for ordination on my first ordination retreat, which was on the theme of going for refuge. And I said I did feel it being welcomed in. I felt I was surrendering, giving myself over to something bigger, something mysterious. And there was elements of purification, integration, and there was a sense of place, that this was my place in the world. It was almost like I was in a different realm. I remember that retreat quite vividly. It was challenging what was real and what wasn't real. I had a real connection with this figure here, Dado Rinpoche. This man. And to drink. I saw that picture a long time ago, this very image with the Bhante's teachers, and I didn't know anything about anybody, but it was just something about his face. I was on a meditation retreat in Vajraloka, and that picture just happened to be on the shrine. But I kept with open eyes and looking at his face. I was very moved by his face and smile. And then I remember seeing this picture on Padmaloka. It's that same photograph, but it's very, very clear. And I remember standing looking at it. And it was like, by then I'd known a bit more about him, I'd read a bit about him, but it was almost like he was there. It was almost like I had him in front of me. It's such a vivid experience. He's got a little pen on his in his robe. In fact, he was famous for keeping lots of things in his robe, and he would know when things would be needed, and he'd just pull them out the right time. And there's a story of him, they're going to temples and what to pay respects, and they didn't have any candles, and it's a big thing not to have offerings in India. And then suddenly he pulled out like 50 candles and incense, and it was just at the right moment. So I guess that's an example of how you can just connect with an image without really knowing much about all the ins and outs. I guess just letting myself feel. So I had lots of dreams on that retreat, vivid dreams, and Surita was doing my study group, and at the start of it he would ask any dreams, and it was like every time I would have more and more dreams to bring. It was like the whole study group would be taking all of my vivid dreams. And another thing I felt was just a lot of gratitude. Tears of gratitude, tears, I suppose that's an aspect of faith, but I just felt very grateful to have came across the Dharma, came across the Buddha, his teaching, and I just thought, well, I've been taking all this for granted, and just some emotion just came over and got me with just tears of gratitude. Okay, the visualization starts with the blue sky. The blue sky is kind of an analogy of uncluttered mind. If we haven't maybe practice meditation before we visualize the blue sky. We might not get a sense of the blue sky. It's just open space, a fertile void in all directions, a bit like the end of the Metta-bhavana, going in all directions, below, above, all sides. And then emerges out of the blue sky a rainbow cloud. I've actually saw a real rainbow cloud once on the way to Pavloka, because it's got big skies and low land, and it's just like it's twinkling with colour. The rainbow's drops are caught in it. So again, it's a mysterious thing, an unusual thing, an auspicious, positive thing that emerges out of it. The deep blue circle in the image on the right is just an artistic device. I think it's just balancing the top half. He's just put that in. And the other ones don't have that in. And then out of the blue sky emerges, it's more like a lotus or a flower. It's a lotus tree, really. So a white bud, and then it gradually opens. And then another bud opens, another bud opens, and then figures appear on the lotuses. The lotus is a symbol of, again, endless meanings, growth, compassion, development, the three yanas of Buddhism. There's so many different meanings to a lot of lotuses, but again, it's more about the feeling and sense of it as we visualize it. And then first appears the Buddha, and the Buddha of the past and the Buddha of the future, the Pankhya and Maitreya. I'm going to go back to the blue sky before we go any further. It's important we get this blue sky right. So this is Lama Govinda, one of Sangharakshita's great Buddhists of the 20th century. Was German, Tibetan, studied under Tibetan schools. When humankind look up into the space of heaven and invoke heaven or a power that is supposed to reside there, they invoke in reality forces within themselves which by being projected outwards are visualized or felt as heaven or cosmic space. If we contemplate the mysterious depth and blueness of the firmament, we contemplate the depths of our own inner being, of our own mysterious, all-compromising consciousness in its primordial, unsullied purity, unsullied by thoughts and mental representations, undivided by discriminations, desires and aversions. Herein lies the indescribable and inexplicable happiness which fills us during such contemplation. So Rugi Chen is on the left of Sangharakshita, and he says, one of his famous quotes is, other than the blue sky, anything other than the blue sky, if you don't get the blue sky right, the sense of emptiness right, then everything else is just vulgar magic. So the Buddha, Shakyamuni, is in the middle, his bowl, and we've got the Pankhya, Buddha of the past, Maitreya, Buddha of the future, and this is the Buddha of the three times. And again, it's emphasising this dimension. There's a story, I think it is the Pelican, where the Buddha, a light appears on his forehead, and he shows all sorts of other realms, and other Buddhas. And it was like, how can this happen? He's the Buddha, he's the historical Buddha. What does this mean? So again, it's like this idea of expanding beyond time and space, and that's the same job that the symbols of the moon and the sun. It's not day, it's not night, it's not twilight. It's an unusual time, out of time. traditional image or a way of looking at the refuse tree is to think of it as a flower with bees on it, squirming around, flying around. It's almost like full of life. So then the other lotuses appear at either side of the Buddha. On the left we've got the Buddha's Bodhisattvas, and on the right we've got the what known as the Arhats. And the Arhats are traditionally depicted as elderly monks or nuns. And the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are bodies of light. And I'm always struck by how they correspond to each other in the image. I sometimes think it's the same figure that's came back in a body of light, in a subtle body, because they kind of correspond. And although there's only a certain amount of Bodhisattvas on there, by implication they're all there. The Mahayadhamma isn't there. Mahayadhamma is white tower, but there's green tower. But by implication they're all there. So on the left we've got Manjushri with his sword, a peaceful Vajrapani, Shantigarbha, Avalokiteshvara, and Green Tara or Aryatara. And then on the right we've got Sariputra, Rodha Glayana, Ananda, Mahakashyapa, and Damodina. You see how Aryatara and Damodina correspond, the female figures correspond. And there's five of each. And then another lotus opens behind, and that's the text, the Dharma, the text through the ages. So it's almost like we're getting this kind of candelabra effect. There's one in the middle, there's one in front, there's one behind, there's two on the other side. And the one in front is Sangharakshita and his teachers. So we've got Mr. Chen, or sometimes Yogi Chen. He was a Chan practitioner, a Taoist, and a Vajrayana practitioner. He's to the left of Sangharakshita. And then we've got Chetul Sangri Dorje, who's above Yogi Chen. To the right of Sangharakshita we've got Jagdish Kashyap. And then we've got Dada Rinpoche, the man I was talking about above. So these are all people Bhante met and was influenced by. And there's lots of wonderful stories that I don't have time to tell you about, but he met them as he was travelling through India. And he received initiations from them, such as Green Tara and White Tara. And I'll just say who we've got at the top. We've got Gujong Rinpoche and Jamyang Kentse Rinpoche and Delgo Kentse Rinpoche. The Rinpoche is also Tibetan teachers. So he's got a mixture of Tibetan, Chan, Theravada in this bottom right. So take this cash in. So these appear, and then in the background, more like floating in space, we've got teachers of the past, and they come from the Japanese, Chinese, Tibetan, and Indian traditions. So there's Hakuin, Kukai, Dogen, Shinran. I saw a little clip of Bhante recently talking about Shinran. He said that he had the phrase Shinran spoke about, that he said about himself, that he was neither monk nor lay, which is kind of, it's good to have people in history who have had that similar approach. And then the Chinese level above that, there's Huneng, Chi Ai, and Swan Tsai. And then we have Tibetan teachers, Milarepa, Atisha, Padmasambhava, and Tsongkhapa. Padmasambhava to Tibetans is sometimes known as the second Buddha. You can look a bit wrathful, but it's sad that some people find him a bit scary because he's sitting on a red lotus, which is compassion. And he holds a cat of anger, which has got three heads on it. One dead, one recently severed, and one in between. And the Dakini is sometimes known as can come out of the Katbanga, and it corresponds to the Dakini as well. So again, there could be a talk in one of these figures, a whole talk in all the different symbolism. And then above that we have the Indian teachers, Vasubandhu, Shantideva, Buddha Ghosha, Nagarjuna and Asanga. And then above the teachers of the past we've got the mandala of the five Buddhas, which is here. So Vilochana, the white Buddha in the middle, Ratnasambhava, the yellow, Amitabha, the red, Amoghasiddhi, the green, Akshobhya, the blue. Again, they're different aspects of the enlightenment. They're not as such historical figures, they're the kind of first archetypal Buddhas and represent different qualities. Amitabha, compassion, Ratnasambhava, sort of generosity and wealth, Vilochana, illumination, Amoghasiddhi, fearlessness, and Akshobhya, sort of earth-touching and wisdom. And he holds a Vajra. Amoghasiddhi holds his hand up, and you sometimes see walking Buddhas depicting this mudra, which means fearlessness. So sometimes you see a Shakyamuni figure depicting fearlessness. Another unusual experience was my mum was ill in hospital. She died a long time ago now, about 7 years ago, and I was practicing Tonglen, which is kind of like an extension of Metta-Bhavana. Really, you're basically wishing the person that's ill or dying to be what to be. Not, well, I was thinking of fearlessness. I didn't want her to be frightened. I wanted her to be okay. And she opened her eyes and said, "Oh, there's a man behind you standing with his hand raised." So maybe the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are around us. Who knows? And the very last figure at the top is Vajrasattva, the primordial Buddha, again emphasizing this timelessness. He's also concerned with purity. And around the refuge tree are goddesses and gods, reminding us that the Buddha was actually a teacher of gods and goddesses as much as humans. So then we dissolve the practice. Each lotus and tongue and each figure and tongue dissolves into the Buddhas of three times, including the texts. And then the Pankhya and Maitreya dissolve into Shakyamuni. And then Shakyamuni dissolves, and then the white lotus. They're all sitting on moon mats, and the moon mat dissolves, and the white lotus dissolves. And then we're left sitting in the blue sky again. And then we let the blue sky disappear. I always had a kind of, when I did it, I was kind of a sense of sadness at the end that it's all gone somehow. But then I could just imagine it being back there at any time, that it's always there. But the Dharma Nama, the reign of the Dharma, the golden light of the Sutra of Golden Light, it's always there, and you can always contact it in a way. So, at the point of ordination, we're given one figure, and I got into a real tiz with this. I couldn't remember all the figures, and I got really frustrated, and I was doing it. I loved it on retreat, but when I got home, I found it really difficult. And in the end, I just had a sense, which is okay to have a sense of the three figures and a general sense of the other figures around, a sense of the Buddha the Buddha of the three times. And then when I took up my sadhana, again, it was all the things I've spoken about, bringing it into practice, engaging with the image. So an older member, really responsibility to practice and to keep this level of effective practice up, and to keep up that level of going for refuge, and again to have to go back and practice meditations, the ethics, rituals, etc.
So I just want to, coming to the end, I just want to finish with a quote from one of the Tibetan teachers, Shantideva.
Today my birth is fruitful. My human life is justified. Today I am born into the family of the Buddha. Now I am the Buddha's son. So that there may be no blemish upon the spotless family, I must now act as becomes my family. As a blind man might find a jewel in a heap of rubbish, so too this awakening mind has somehow appeared in me. Today I summon the world to Buddhahood and to worldly happiness. Meanwhile, in the presence of all the saviours, may gods, titans, and all rejoice. So I just like to say thanks for listening, preparing for this talk can help me deepen my understanding of practice of the Dharma, going for refuge. So I hope listening has helped you deepen your understanding, helping you going for refuge, not just at this talk, but the whole series of talks. So I hope it sparked your imagination, sparked your faith, sparked your Shraddha, and inspired you to go deeper at whatever level in your practice of